Good evening. Tonight we take up chapter 26 in The Life Divine, the Ascending Series of Substance, which appeared first in the Aria in September of 1916. Now it's interesting, Sri Aurobindo has substituted the opening citations with retranslated material and some additional material. What originally stood in the Aria read in this way: "The Lord of the Wine of Immortality is like a brilliant mortal making pure and luminous the body. He comes pouring into all the sheath. His vast streams are released forth, and he enters into these jars." That is a piece from the ninth mandala of the Rig Veda, and all that mandala is dedicated to Soma, the god of delight. He will keep that, but retranslate and add a verse to it. But he prefaces it with two other citations. The first is from our familiar Taittiriya Upanishad. It's not a direct quote. He's taking some phrases from each of the first five verses in the second chapter and translated it in this way. "There is a self that is of the essence of matter. There is another inner self of life that fills the other. There is another inner self of mind. There is another inner self of truth knowledge. There is another inner self of bliss." And then he goes to the first mandala of the Rig Veda. And this is a hymn to Indra. "They climb Indra like a ladder. As one mounts peak after peak, there becomes clear the much that has still to be done. Indra brings consciousness of that as the goal." Consciousness could be translated here also as rain in English, but to Sri Aurobindo, rain is a manifestation of consciousness. Indra, by the way, to keep it brief, is the god of the divine mind. One has to reach the divine mind to go beyond it. Indra is conscious of that, tad, as his will is to be done. Now, we come to the citation from the ninth mandala, and this, of course, is a hymn dedicated to Soma. "Like a hawk, a kite, he settles on the vessel and upbears it. In his stream of movement, he discovers the rays, for he goes bearing his weapons. He cleaves to the ocean surge of the waters. A great king, he declares the fourth status, Turiya Dhamma. Like a mortal purifying his body, like a war horse galloping to the conquest of riches, he pours, calling through all the sheath, and enters these vessels." You can see how much fuller it is when he adds the other verse and translates it in this way. So many images come in here. Like a hawk, well, the nature of the soul is to soar. He cleaves to the ocean surge of the waters. Also, our spirit is oceanic. A great king, in other words, sovereign, ruler, not subject, but sovereign. And he declares the fourth status. Now, to Sri Aurobindo, that fourth status obviously is that linking world of the supermind, because above There is the divine trinity of Satchit Ananda, and what we experience here below is the lower trinity, matter, life, mind. The great king, of course, stands there, connecting the two worlds, the higher and the lower, in that fourth status. Like a mortal purifying his body. Aha, we're back to the earth principle. Like a war horse galloping to the conquest of riches. And what is the war horse but the power of life properly directed, given the opportunity to go with great force, which it loves to do, but according to the will of the divine who commands from above. He goes there, calling through all the sheath, and enters these vessels. Who enters the vessels? The soma, the delight, which stands as the burgeoning bliss that gives movement to all of this, to the soaring soul, to the surging ocean of the spirit, to the king who stands surveying all, sovereign. All of this is the manifestation of bliss. But it must have form. It must take shape. So now he begins to connect the various chapters that have led to this 26th so that we can look at them in order. See what it is they mean to suggest. We'll get halfway through the chapter tonight and finish the rest next week. First paragraph. If we consider what it is that most represents to us the materiality of matter, we shall see that it is its aspects of solidity, tangibility, increasing resistance, firm response to the touch of sense. Substance seems more truly material and real in proportion as it presents to us a solid resistance, and by virtue of that resistance, a durability of sensible form on which our consciousness can dwell. In proportion as it is more subtle, less densely resistant, and enduringly seizable by the sense, it appears to us less material. Put simply, the character of matter, then, is its tangibility. Tangible, from tangere, the Latin for touchable. We can touch matter. We can touch its forms. And because it resists, we can feel it. If it didn't resist, we'd go right through it. So it has densified itself in a way that our sense can appreciate, can grasp, can work with. This attitude of our ordinary consciousness towards matter is a symbol of the essential object for which matter has been created. Substance passes into the material status in order that it may present to the consciousness, which has to deal with it, durable, firmly seizable images on which the mind can rest and base its operations, and which the life can handle with at least a relative surety of permanence in the form upon which it works. So it gives us a durable, touchable form. Therefore, in the ancient Vedic formula, earth, prithvi, type of the more solid states of substance, was accepted as the symbolic name of the material principle. So matter is earth. Therefore, too, touch or contact is for us the essential basis of sense, so connecting the principle of earth, the goddess of the earth, with the founding sense of touch. That comes first. All other physical senses, taste, smell, hearing, sight, are based upon a series of more and more subtle and indirect contacts between the percipient and the perceived. Well, you can just see that. So touch, you have to be right next to it, right? And then comes taste, and then smell, a little more distant, and then hearing, it can be quite distant. Sight can be the most distant. So the senses gather information from more and more distant preserves. Less and less direct between the percipient, that is to say, the person who perceives, and the perceived, the object that we're attempting to touch, to smell, to taste, to hear, to see. Equally, in the Samkhya classification of the five elemental states of substance from ether to earth, we see that their characteristic is a constant progression from the more subtle to the less subtle, so that at the summit we have the subtle vibrations of the ethereal, and at the base the grosser density of the earthly or solid elemental condition. So, precipitated downwards from above. But again, he's accepting the Sankhya system of analysis of nature. And by implication, then, he finds it agreeable. If you remember, it is a relationship between Purusha and Prakriti that establishes the movement of the cosmos in the Sankhya system. Purusha is the conscious being, the true person, who is sheer awareness. Prakriti is nature, apparently distinct from the person, and yet who never moves unless the person gives attention. So it is the attention of the person that causes nature to produce. And the first thing that it produces is this great awareness, mahas, the vast awareness, which seems to be the organizing intelligence of the buddhi, which extends itself in the sense of self, which then, as a self, wants to experience and so organizes a mind to gather data for it. But data don't exist yet. And so senses must come into being. The senses project subtle objects. Those subtle objects become dense objects. And hence the senses can begin to work and gather all of this information. But it is all arriving as dispositive from above. Because Purusha originally looks and intelligence comes into being, separating the subject and object, saying, I am here and that is there, that any of this is at all formed. So Sri Aurobindo, by using this, asserts that he likes it, that he agrees with this approach to analysis of nature, but also accepts it in a sense that it is a continuation of a lengthy Indian tradition. And this Sankhya classification of nature and this distinction between person and world arises from the sage Kapila, who has no Vedic orientation, who stands outside the Veda, who is earlier even than the Vedic presence in India. We'll leave that little historical nugget alone for now, because we've dealt with it when we went through the Indian spiritual tradition. But interesting it is that the Sankhya system, the enumeration system, based upon Kapila's insights, continues all the way up to the present day into Sri Aurobindo. Now, back to his study. Matter Therefore, is the last stage known to us in the progress of pure substance towards a basis of cosmic relation, in which the first word shall be not spirit but form, and form in its utmost possible development of concentration, resistance, durably gross image, mutual impenetrability, the culminating point of distinction, separation, and division. This is the intention and character of the material universe. It is the formula of accomplished divisibility. So things are maximally discrete. They stand apart from each other. Forms so established are mutually impenetrable. In other words, two bodies can't occupy the same space at the same time. These forms, of course, are not absolute. They are relatively durable. For a time, they come into formation, and they last. It gives the spirit enough time to do something with them and learn what's going on in the play of the cosmos. Back to Sri Aurobindo. And if there is, as there must be in the nature of things, an ascending series in the scale of substance from matter to spirit, it must be marked by a progressive diminution of these capacities, most characteristic of the physical principle, and a progressive increase of the opposite characteristics, which will lead us to the formula of pure spiritual self-extension. In other words, as we climb from matter back towards spirit, these things which are so characteristic of matter must recede in importance. They must give way and things become more fluid. And if they're self-extensive, they are increasingly penetrable. This is to say that they must be marked by less and less bondage to the form, more and more subtlety and flexibility of substance and force, more and more interfusion, interpenetration, power of assimilation, power of interchange, power of variation, transmutation, unification. So there's a great play. Things can merge into each other. They can separate. They can have association. They can have relationship. They can change each other. One thing can influence another. So as we rise, there is more power for there to be an exchange like that, and not the strenuous resistance of matter, which does not wish to yield its given form. Matter, then, tends to be impenetrable. Spirit tends towards interpenetration, because everything wants to be a unity there. Drawing away from durability of form, we draw towards eternity of essence. Drawing away from our poise in the persistent separation and resistance of physical matter, we draw near to the highest divine poise in the infinity, unity, and indivisibility of spirit. So, between gross substance and pure spirit substance, this must be the fundamental antinomy. In matter, chit, or conscious force, masses itself more and more to resist and stand out against other masses of the same conscious force. In substance of spirit, pure consciousness images itself freely in its sense of itself with an essential indivisibility and a constant unifying interchange as the basic formula even of the most diversifying play of its own force. Between these two poles, there is the possibility of an infinite gradation. Well, he's not rehearsing here why it is that matter reaches this condition of maximum discretion, you might say. But he's just asserting that there is this continuum of being. This massing, which he describes here, densifies conscious force into discrete clusterings, so to speak. Whereas when we arrive at the spiritual status of things, there is indivisibility. There is oneness of form. Self sees same self in other, which to the material perspective is not of visibility, cannot be seen. These considerations become of great importance when we consider the possible relation between the divine life and the divine mind of the perfected human soul and the very gross and seemingly undivine body or formula of physical being in which we actually dwell. So what relates us from that to this? That formula is the result of a certain fixed relation between sense and substance from which the material universe has started. But as this relation is not the only possible relation, so that formula is not the only possible formula. Life and mind may manifest themselves in another relation to substance and work out different physical laws, other and larger habits, even a different substance of body with a freer action of the sense, a freer action of the life, a freer action of the mind. So the current relation of life and mind in body reflects the beginnings of the cosmos as we started. But another relation is possible. Physical laws can change. They are not inalienable. They are subject to the rule of consciousness, and so can be altered. Death, division, mutual resistance, and exclusion between embodied masses of the same conscious life force are the formula of our physical existence. The narrow limitation of the play of the senses, the determination within a small circle of the field, duration and power of the life workings, the obscuration, lame movement, broken and bounded functioning of the mind, are the yoke which that formula expressed in the animal body has imposed upon the higher principles. In other words, this is a description of our current state of things. We're dogged by death, we're limited, we're obscured, but these aren't necessarily our future. As he says, but these things are not the sole possible rhythm of cosmic nature. There are superior states, there are higher worlds. And if the law of these can by any progress of man and by any limitation, by any liberation of our substance from its present imperfections be imposed on this sensible form and instrument of our being, then there may be, even here, a physical working of divine mind and sense, a physical working of divine life in the human frame, and even the evolution upon earth of something that we may call a divinely human body. So what he asserts is that the laws of higher worlds may manifest here through human progress and evolution. Because in these higher worlds, there are also laws by which consciousness engages with its self-expression in form and power. Those laws can be expressed here because of the continuum of being. It is not impossible, it is not impermissible that higher truths can manifest here. Sri Aurobindo says that is a potency that lies in all of nature. The body of man, he concludes, also may someday come by its transfiguration. The Earth Mother too may reveal in us her Godhead. So, in us discovering what the secret of the body is, we bring to fulfillment the hidden possibilities of the Earth Goddess, Prithvi, here in nature. She may make that manifestation available to us. We will be the agency of its articulation. So, even within the formula of the physical cosmos, there is an ascending series in the scale of matter which leads us from the more to the less dense, from the less to the more subtle, where we reach the highest term of that series, the most supra-ethereal subtlety of material substance or formulation of force. What lies beyond? Not a nihil, not a void. For there is no such thing as absolute void or real nullity. And what we call by that name is simply something beyond the grasp of our sense, our mind, or our most subtle consciousness. Again, this is a refusal that Sri Aurobindo asserts, to allow that the cosmos arises from non-being. Non-being in its literal sense. He uses the term in a restricted sense to mean that which escapes into its own liberation from its own freedom, any positive assignation of its being. It may assert itself as positive being, but always it is free even from that self-determination. And in that we can say that it is non-being. But that there is a zero, that there is a nothingness at the start of all, he says that cannot be. He is, again, fundamentally a realist. Nor is it true, he writes, that there is nothing beyond or that some ethereal substance of matter is the eternal beginning. This goes back to the Sankhya scheme, writing about the Mula Prakriti, that the root of Prakriti is some kind of ethereal, undescribable something. He does not accept that. For we know that matter and material force are only a last result of a pure substance and pure force, in which consciousness is luminously self-aware and self-possessing, and not, as in matter, lost to itself in an inconscient sleep and an inert motion. Because above there is this chit shakti, this conscious power. In its relation to itself, the supramental awareness stands forth, manifests diversity within this self-held unity, all of it expressive of oneself, and then giving license to the mind to assert maximum separativity allows the relationship of mind with conscious force to extend itself into form as matter. So matter does not begin from its own being, it begins as a play of consciousness. It is not rooted in a mystery. What is mysterious to the mind is not a mystery to the open spiritual consciousness itself. What then is there between this material substance and that pure substance? For we do not leap from the one to the other. We do not pass at once from the inconscient to absolute consciousness. There must be, and there are, grades between inconscient substance and utterly self-conscious self-extension, as between the principle of matter and the principle of spirit. So he's describing a substance of spirit that is above, which is in full unity with what is below. There must be grades, but all these grades are interpenetrating, flow from one to the other, and cannot be absolutely separated any from the other. And so, he comes to it now. All who have at all sounded those abysses are agreed and bear witness to this fact, that there are a series of subtler and subtler formulations of substance which escape from and go beyond the formula of the material universe. Now, in sounding those abysses, remember Sri Aurobindo gives some credibility to the philosophic mind, to reason, but to discover truth, he gives greater credibility to the spiritual awareness, which has the experience of these great truths. So it is one who has realized inwardly that has properly sounded these abysses, not one who has thought about it. One who has realized, then expressing in thought form, puts forth a spiritual philosophy which is grounded upon truth. And so far as words can hold and convey that vision, they have power and meaning. So philosophy, for it to be really valuable, must be based upon spiritual realization. It is the vision of the rishi which gives one that. And it is to such persons that Sri Aurobindo refers in this sentence. Without going deeply into matters which are too occult and difficult for our present inquiry, we may say, adhering to the system on which we have based ourselves, that these gradations of substance, in one important aspect of their formulation in series, can be seen to correspond to the ascending series of matter, life, mind, supermind, and that other higher divine triplicity of Satchit Ananda. In other words, we find that substance in its ascension bases itself upon each of these principles and makes itself successively a characteristic vehicle for the dominating cosmic self-expression of each in their ascending series. So conscious substance willingly bases itself in each range of being. It is not that it is absent in matter. It has willingly staged itself here and in life, and in mind, and in supermind, as it has actually in Satchit Ananda. So each of these expressions is a vehicle through which being says, I am here. Here in the material world, he writes, everything is founded upon the formula of material substance. Sense, life, thought found themselves upon what the ancients called the earth power. Start from it, obey its laws, accommodate their workings to this fundamental principle, limit themselves by its possibilities, and if they would develop others, have even in that development to take account of the original formula, its purpose, and its demand upon the divine evolution. The sense works through physical instruments. The life through a physical nerve system and vital organs. The mind has to build its operations upon a corporeal basis and use a material instrumentation, even in its pure mental workings, have to take the data so derived as a field and as the stuff upon which it works. So all these powers of being, life and mind, agree to the conditions that matter imposes upon it so that they can explore and work in the cosmos as founded in matter. There is no necessity in the essential nature of mind, sense, life that they should be so limited, for the physical sense organs are not the creators of sense perceptions, but themselves the creation, the instruments, and here a necessary convenience of the cosmic sense. The nervous system and vital organs are not the creators of life's action and reaction, but themselves the creation, the instruments, and here a necessary convenience of the cosmic life force. The brain is not the creator of thought, but itself the creation, the instrument, and here a necessary convenience of the cosmic mind. The necessity, then, is not absolute, but teleological. It is the result of a divine cosmic will in the material universe which intends to posit here a physical relation between sense and its object, establishes here a material formula and law of conscious force, and creates by it physical images of conscious being to serve as the initial dominating and determining fact of the world in which we live. So again, Sri Aurobindo has drawn us a picture of how this works from the above to the below. The physical sense organs are not the creators of sense perceptions, but themselves the creation. The senses extend themselves below to the objects. The nervous system and vital organs are not the creators of life's action, but themselves the creation. So life extends itself into the organs of life, just as the senses, subtle senses, extended themselves into the objects. And the mind has extended itself into the brain, so as to have physical bases, all of them, in the play of matter. Why does it do this? For a reason. The necessity, then, is not absolute. It's not that these principles have to do it. They do it for a reason. It's teleological. What does teleological mean? Telos, end, purpose. Logos, discourse. So it is, teleology is the doctrine of final causes. It tells us why the divine does this in the universe. So Sri Aurobindo is coming out and telling you very directly that the universe is a direct expression of the divine will. The divine has a reason for doing this, and here it is. It is not a fundamental law of being, but a constructive principle necessitated by the intention of the spirit to evolve in a world of matter. So, the cosmic limits are based on material form, deliberately determined by the spirit, which wants to evolve in and through matter. It is said, I will establish these limits. I agree to them. I enter into them. And so it shall be, because it wants to rise out of it, as he says, to evolve in a world of matter. Now we'll see that this intention of the evolution is to reach reunification with the spiritual substance above, but it begins from what seems to be maximally divided forms clustered in the material realm. All these forms seem to resist unification, seem to want to stand against connection to others, let alone penetration by others. Whereas the spirit above is a play of identity, even in diversity. So what connects them all is this thrust of the evolutionary power out of matter through life and mind back into conscious spirit to reconnect the worlds. To make those connections at least obvious, Where would they be obvious? In matter itself, in the forms themselves. For that to happen, material laws have to yield their suzerainty to greater laws. The laws of being, which are native to higher planes, must become operative here. This is the sense of what Sri Aurobindo is telling us here. Well, this argument will be made more clear next week as he reaches his conclusion. And then beyond that is the chapter, wonderful chapter, called The Sevenfold Cord of Being. As if all the planes of the cosmos played at one time, form this sonorous, harmonious chord, which we can all hear. So, this evening, I think it's appropriate for us to read from Savitri in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, from the first canto, The World Stare, in which he describes all these linked gradations of cosmic being. I'm going to come into it a couple of pages into the canto. Tireless the heart's adventure of delight, endless the kingdoms of the spirit's bliss. Unnumbered tones struck from one harmony's strings, each to its wide-winged universal poise, its fathomless feeling of the all in one, brought notes of some perfection yet unseen. Its single retreat into truth's secrecies, its happy sidelight on the infinite. All was found there the unique has dreamed and made, tinging with ceaseless rapture and surprise, and an opulent beauty of passionate difference, the recurring beat that moments God in time. Only was missing the sole timeless word that carries eternity in its lonely sound, the idea, self-luminous key to all ideas, the integer of the spirit's perfect sum that equates the unequal all to the equal one, the single sign interpreting every sign, the absolute index to the absolute. There, walled apart by its own innerness, in a mystical barrage of dynamic light, he saw a lone, immense, high-curved world pile, erect like a mountain chariot of the gods, motionless under an inscrutable sky. As if from matter's plinth and viewless base, to a top as viewless, a carved sea of worlds, climbing with foam-maned waves to the supreme, ascended towards breadths immeasurable. It hoped to soar into the ineffable's reign. 100 levels raised it to the unknown. So it towered up to heights intangible and disappeared in the hushed conscious vast as climbs a storied temple tower to heaven, built by the aspiring soul of man to live near to his dream of the invisible. Infinity calls to it as it dreams and climbs. Its spire touches the apex of the world. Mounting into great voiceless stillnesses, it marries the earth to screened eternities. amid the many systems of the One, made by an interpreting creative joy. Alone it points us to our journey back, out of our long self-loss in nature's deeps. Planted on earth, it holds in it all realms. It is a brief compendium of the vast. This was the single stair to being's goal. So I think we'll put our bookmark there for the evening. Namaste, Jai Ma.